Hey, my name's Ben Brown, and this is the Where's the British panel. I kind of chose this title somewhat randomly because I wanted to talk a little bit about the digital rights organisations that already exist, and kind of unfortunately in some ways, both in the US and in Britain, all digital rights organisations get sort of bundled into this idea of the EFF, whereas in fact there's a lot more. Why are you pointing up, Steph? Is that a question?
Stand up.
Oh, you want to stand up?
Yeah, we can't see you. We love you.
Can't you people like climb on one another's shoulders or something?
Yeah.
All right, so here's the plan. The people we have assembled here today are actually the people who are doing a lot of work in the UK at the moment in the kind of areas that people would normally describe as the sort of stuff the EFF does. So these people are, for all intents and purposes, the British EFF at the moment. And I'm just going to go around and membership organisation of four. I'm just going to go around and each of them introduce themselves and talk a little bit about what's been going on in the certain areas and what their organisations do. So I'm going to start with Ian. Yes, and apparently you have to stand up.
My name is Ian Brown. I've been involved in various digital rights organisations in the UK for probably 7 or 8 years now. Firstly, on an area that I don't know even how many of you in the room would have been interested in, because it seems so long ago, restrictions on cryptography and DGP and that whole area. And that turned in the UK more generally into legislation on surveillance of the internet, the Regulation of the Investigatory Powers Act, which we and other people in the UK spent a lot of time over several years working on, both the primary legislation, which I think was 2000, and follow-up pieces of secondary legislation since. I also have been involved on intellectual property issues. I was director of Foundation for Information Policy Research for 2 years, during which time we spent a lot of effort on the Copyright Directive, the Copyright Directive and its implementation in the UK, and the EU's last attempt at intellectual property legislation, the Enforcement of Intellectual Property Rights Directive. So, on the privacy side, FIPA has been there, but also I've worked a lot with Privacy International, which is another NGO you've probably heard of, has been in the news a lot recently over the ID card debate. The government obviously finally sort of reached the end of its tether on that because it unusually got very personal and attacked Simon Davies, who's the director of Privacy International, over a report that he was part of putting together at the London School of Economics, so the cost of the scheme, but also over a lot of other problems with it. I have worked with Liberty. Sharmi Chakrabarti, who's the director of Liberty, is on FIPA's advisory board. Liberty, for those of you who haven't seen much of it, is a much more traditional civil rights group. It's, I think, 60 or 70 years old. It was called the National Council on Civil Liberties. They have done a lot of very important civil rights work on things like house arrest for terrorist suspects, but they haven't really moved on to the kind of digital rights that probably most of the people in this room are interested in any big way. In some ways, they are the most EFF-like organisation, actually, in the UK. You wouldn't think it from looking at their sort of public presence and branding, but they are actually a lot of smart lawyers who take test cases, which is a lot of what EFF does. And that's something that FIPO and Privacy International haven't done at all, actually. A, because we haven't had the legal resource, and B, because the opportunities for achieving policy change in that way is more limited in the UK and the EU. Although we do recently have the Human Rights Act, it doesn't go nearly as far as the US Constitution. It doesn't allow courts to strike down acts of Parliament. It merely says they can ask Parliament to look again at something if they find that it isn't human rights compliant, and that then leads you having to go all the way up to the European Court of Human Rights. So there are a variety of groups doing bits and pieces of what EFF does. They don't have the cohesive branding, which I think is something that EFF UK might bring to it. But I'll leave perhaps more of that to Corey and to Lewis.
Okay, well, I guess I should say very briefly, but bring into anything what I've organizing been involved with. I started out at UKCDR.
You introduce yourself.
Oh, that's what I'm saying, Rufus Pollock from the Open Knowledge Foundation. How I got involved in this whole thing was through a group called UKCDR, and I then did work with FFII, which works with software patents, with Friends of the Creative Domain, on BBC Creative Archive and copyright type matters, and the Open Knowledge Foundation Network, which I set up with various other people. We've been going for about 18 months. But I think rather than go through all the specific organisations, I want to get at the core here, which is, you know, why are we having all these discussions, and, you know, how do we set up organisations and kind of technical things? It's because these issues related to intellectual property, if we use that term, but to the knowledge economy and so on, are suddenly becoming really, really vital. And people just didn't even think about practically 10 or 15 years ago, except for a very small minority. I mean, you know, the WTO TRIPS agreement went through, so all the IP without really many people noticing. And I would say one of the most interesting things, I think we are seeing in this area something similar to an environmental movement 30, 35 years ago. You know, with Rachel Carson and Simon Spring, you know, 56 years ago, no one was much paying attention to environmental issues. And suddenly from the 60s onwards, you've seen the whole generation, the whole spectrum of organisations. I think that's something we've got to remember. There is no, you know, there are project organisations, there are huge foundations, there are grassroots groups, there are a whole spectrum of stuff now working in environmental policy, from the guys in the suits to the guys getting attached with padlocks to, you know, the oil, you know, the oil kind of transport ships. And I think similarly, I'm not sure there's a kind of single solution to how do we organise activism or work or policy change, which is what this is about, right? Really fundamental things about how we organise the information economy. You know, is it going to be totally proprietarised, or is it going to be based on a more open approach? I think all of us here are joined together by a belief in a much more open approach is needed for the best interests of society. And the question, this debate, is about how do we best achieve that? Because at the moment, there are very few organisations that really exist to channel energy and organise it and, you know, represent this vast set of people with concerns here. You know, we're really unrepresented at a political level. You know, it's really, really the case. I think a really classic example was the file sharing cases, which started last September, almost a year ago. And when those cases got settled, they got settled around March, the first set of them. The Times newspaper basically ran the BPI's press release as their front page. That is unacceptable. You may think you may have a whole spectrum of opinion, but for only one side of that debate to be represented is disastrous. It's disastrous for us, it's disastrous for our society. And I think one of the things here is the need, at the most basic level, to be had to someone who's an average journalist to have know who they can call, for example. Who do you call right now if you want to pitch in on IP or digital rights issues? In this thing. No, absolutely, but, you know, on FFI, on software patents, it's beginning to be the case that we generally get called. But that's only happened in the last 6 to 8 months, I would say, that the mainstream newspapers actually call you, and they still get the story completely wrong. I can really tell you from experience. The tech papers get it right. So I don't know, I think the real question here is that we have got to have at least some focal points that the world at large, outside of people in this room, know how to get hold of. But at the same time, I'd also say I don't think there's a single answer. Like the environmental movement, there are going to be a spectrum of organisations that should be connected and that should work together. Because I think the single other biggest thing you always get told is that to win any argument, you need two people. You need the extremists and you need the guys who are going to cut the deal. You need both of those to get change here. It's no good all of us either being extremists or all of us being incredibly mild and like being lawyers and debating all the legal language. We need some people knocking on the door and saying this isn't acceptable, many of the things that are happening. And much of the way that this legislation that does get produced is simply reflecting special interests, a very narrow segment of both the creative economy and of the public. Anyway, I think that suffices for what I want to say.
Everybody on the left, you can be the
extremists. So this is Corey.
Hiya, I'm Corey Doctorow, whose chair just fell over. I'm from Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Here to help you.
The American Electronic Frontier Foundation, although I hasten to point out that I'm Canadian. So I want to start out by talking a little about what EFF does and how EFF got there and what I'm doing here. EFF is not a legal defense organization. There are some very good legal defense organizations, but if you get arrested or something bad happens to you as a result of something on the internet, even if it's material unfair, the chances are EFF won't defend you. EFF is what's called an impact litigator. So what EFF does is we take very, very narrow cases where the facts and the law that's involved have the right confluence that if we argue that case, we'll change the law and we'll improve the law of numbers of people. We don't have the funding or resources to be a legal defense organization. We have contact with lots of attorneys, and we do connect people with other people with attorneys who can represent them and so on, but we don't represent people on the grounds that they're being unfairly prosecuted. There's just not enough resource for us to do that. It's indicative of the time that we live in that there's no way an organization of EFF's, even EFF's fairly substantial size these days, could conceivably take on even a fraction of the worthy cases in the field. EFF didn't start out to be an impact litigator. EFF was founded by a bunch of fairly wealthy technology entrepreneurs and funded by them, people like Steve Wozniak and John Gilmore and so on, who pledged their personal fortune to the idea that of a foundation that would be created to disperse grants to attorneys to defend people in need. And we couldn't find those attorneys. They just didn't exist. And so Mitch Kapoor and some of our other directors started to seek out and hire attorneys, beginning with a guy named Mike Godwin. If you've heard of Mike Godwin's Law, that Mike Godwin. And when you run into him and you call him a Nazi, he thinks it's very funny. And then a string of other very talented attorneys have come through, including our current very brilliant legal staff. And that's how EFF got to where it is today. So we do a lot of impact litigation. We do a fair bit of grassroots organization, which involves direct letter-writing campaigns to legislators, to companies, to policymakers, and to other entities who are in decision-making capacity. We do a fair bit of work on policy standards and treaties, which is very dull, very wonkish kind of work, where you essentially go into the belly of the beast. You turn up at a meeting where really only kind of one side of the debate has ever been heard, where they've got complete capture of the people who are decision-makers, and you say, I'm sorry, 2 plus 2 does in fact equal 4, and they go, you're out of your mind. and you do that, there are a couple of positive outcomes that arise from that. One is sometimes you change their minds. Another is sometimes you change the minds of the regulator or the legislator or one group of the participants who have been captured by the other side, and they start to say, well, you know, either we'll be embarrassed in the court of public opinion when this happens, or we'll be, or we've seen the light and we'll change. And then the final one is that you do go and you humiliate them in the court of public opinion, and they change their minds. So, for example, when Diebold was ordered by the Supreme Court, or rather when the voting machines were ordered by the Supreme Court to be standardized in time for the next election in the United States, Diebold and a number of other vendors turned up at the standards body where this was being standardized and said, well, you lot don't actually have time to create a new standard and then make reference design and get it in the field and get it trained up and so on. And despite the fact that all the people who've watched this have said that electronic voting machines need to keep a paper record because when they crash, we've seen malfeasance where people like log in and manufacture plausible voting counts so that they don't get in trouble for sourcing bad technology. We need paper records of them. And despite all that, what we think you should do is just take all these stuff that is in the field today, all these machines that failed us so dramatically in the last election, and call them the standard, right? And that's the effort that we'd like you to make. And we brought in a bunch of security experts who said, no, this is bad, this is the wrong thing to do. And they said, no, you're 2 plus 2 does in fact equal 5. And we argued and argued and argued about this. And they started to play games. So they would call quorum after people had to get on airplanes. Or they would find tiny loopholes in the policy that would let them push things through without getting a vote and so on. And what we ended up doing was getting hundreds of members of that standards body, which is a large, well-respected standards body, it's the IEEE, to write members into the executive saying this whole thing needs to be scrapped and start over again, which is what they did. So that's the standards and policy and treaty work. I've just come back from 3 days in Geneva, where we were arguing about whether or not new copyright and other knowledge goods treaties will consider whether or not they're good for human rights or whether they're just monotonically increasing the rights available to private interests. What we don't do very well is kind of grassroots stuff that goes beyond letter writing or sending us a check. And historically, it's been an enormous problem for us. As entities involved in litigation and lobbying, we have a real concern that if there were chapters or other groups who were empowered to speak on EFF's behalf, that we could turn up in court and find what they'd said being held against us. This has already happened in a couple of our cases. And so we've never had chapters. We've never really had any kind of local organizations doing what they do and so on. It's been a hamstringing thing for us. We've recently started to find new ways of bringing community into us. So we've got now software development projects where hackers can contribute. That was always a big one. We get all kinds of coders and techie people writing in and saying, "Oh, I know you want a check. I sent you a check, but I code. What kind of code can I write for freedom?" And so we've identified and are now leading some free software projects where your code really does contribute to freedom, but we need other things, for designers and so on. And any organization that came out of a UK, any kind of UK grassroots organization, I think, needs to consider that. Why we're in the European Union? Why I'm here? I'm it. I'm the entire EFF staff in all of Europe. And until a week ago, I was the entire EFF staff not in San Francisco. Now we have one guy in Toronto. And ironically, the Canadian has moved to Europe, the European has moved to San Francisco, and the American has now moved to Canada. So this is our new activism strategy, the cross-pollinating thing. And what we're here for is because in many instances, bad copyright, patent, and trademark rules are achieved by a kind of laundry process that is familiar to anyone who's ever had a small child, where the child goes to mom and mom says, "I'm sorry, you can't have another Mickey." And so they go to dad and ask for a Mickey, and then when dad gives them a Mickey, then they can go back to mom and they can say, "Well, I've got one Mickey, can't I have two?" And so where you find American regulators or legislators unwilling to increase the term of copyright, you find European legislators who are willing to increase it, and then you go back to America and you say, "We need to bridge the gap," and so on and so forth. And I'm here solely to work on those issues where it's likely that we'll have a substantial impact on American legislation, policy, and similar issues. So that's my entire brief here. I'm not here to fill in for what European organizations are doing, because European organizations and British organizations need to work on things that are important to Europeans. And there's some confluence with what's important to us, but it's not the same thing. In America, we recently had an amazing victory in something called the Broadcast Flag, which was a proposal that said that anyone building digital television equipment would have to get the features for that equipment approved by a regulator that had been captured by Hollywood Studios, and would be required to build it in a way that resisted end-user modifications. So you could never have open source or free software in digital television equipment, including PCs. Right? So that it would have substantially undermined the ability of free software authors to make free software for PCs, and for hardware vendors to make hardware that you could build free software drivers for. We thought it was going to be a real disaster. So we defeated it. We went to court with a number of our partners. It was led by another organization called Public Knowledge in D.C., whose chief attorney is our first attorney, Mike Godwin. So, we pollinated a lot of these organizations that we now partner with, and we won. We had a complete crushing victory for the studio, for us, against the studios, who now, if they want to make a broadcast flag happen, have to go and find, instead of a regulator, a lawmaker who's willing to risk his constituency's wrath by implementing a law that breaks the dominant form of entertainment in America. Right, which is a hard row to hoe. I find it unlikely that they'll find these people. But what's happening now is in Europe, there's a similar initiative that not only achieves what the broadcast flag would have achieved, but goes several steps beyond it. It, for example, creates a technological definition of what constitutes a household or family, so that rights holders can queue content so that it can only be used within one household. And then these engineers meeting in smoke-filled rooms with studio executives in back rooms across Europe will have mathematically determined what a valid family arrangement constitutes. It overreaches in many other ways. I'm a part of these negotiations, and they bind us to secrecy, so I can only discuss those elements that the chairman had discussed. But there's lots more I could go into, and I hope to go into as they make more and more disclosures. And I think that's an example of exactly the kind of thing that a European, in particular a UK member-driven activist group, should really be addressing. It's the kind of issue that you don't need to be a geek to understand. to understand that bootstrapping the creator's monopoly on who gets to copy his or her movie into a monopoly on over what constitutes a family or who gets to build equipment that might be used in connection with their movies is wrong. It's unfair. And so that's the kind of thing that I think that a British organization could really work on. Thanks.
It's not out of laziness to stop letting people ask questions, because I imagine that there's quite a few questions in the audience, but I'm just going to do one myself to go around, actually two, which is, I'm going to try and find out from all the people here, what works in a British, and also European, we haven't really talked much about European environments, what works, and also kind of what's missing. If there's anything that we lack, which we've kind of talked a bit about, but probably good to have a longer list. So, start with you.
You have to stand.
What doesn't work, unfortunately, so far, has been in the UK membership organisations.
Right.
I have to say that the organisations that I've been involved with that have tried to get any number of people involved, like FIVR, haven't been very successful. Even a single issue campaign like No to ID, which is campaigning against the UK ID card proposals, which is something you think it's really easy for people to say, yes, I don't like the idea of ID cards, I'm willing to pay a very small amount of money, I think £10 or £15 a year to be a supporter. It's not committing me, you know, there aren't 20 issues that I'm committing to their position on, it's just one thing. Even there, I think the number of members is in the small hundreds. When opinion polls tell us that 3 or 4 million people in the UK will refuse to have ID cards, they feel that's not good.
What do you think that is?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's not that British people don't like membership organisations. When you look at the RSPCA or the RSPB or Greenpeace or, Rufus mentioned the environmental movement, which would be wonderful in 10, 15 years, we could get to that point. I like his point that diversity is sort of strength in that way. I also am not sure how well, I certainly don't think it works as well as the US, activism getting people to actually write to their MPs. I mean, here's an MP in Fogo, which could maybe contradict that, but as far as I can see, MPs here, partly because there isn't Parliament isn't independent from the government in quite the same way it is in the US, I don't know if that leads to stronger party control over how the MPs act. But you don't tend to see MPs, maybe you just haven't had the numbers of people writing to them, but MPs don't seem to change their minds very often based on what their constituents tell them if it would go against party position. Because those two ways of working haven't been major successes in the past, the organisations I've been involved with, Fit Women and Privacy International in particular, I'll talk about the EU in a second as well, I forgot that a moment ago, have tended to concentrate more on traditional lobbying, on actually writing short briefs for MPs and members of the House of Lords, on actually trying to talk to, get appointments with and talk to. In the UK, actually, it's quite dismaying for someone who is a Democrat, but the House of Lords are far more interested in digital rights issues than members of the House of Commons, who largely, particularly Labour. I wasn't really involved following back to say whether Conservative MPs would be exactly the same when Conservatives were in power, but we almost haven't bothered trying to convince Labour MPs on any of these issues because they're really not interested if they would have to vote against the party line because of it. We've had far more success briefing people in the Lords in all parties, and also the Lords has a large independent element called crossbenchers. Who are very interested in these issues, and where we've had success as Fit for Privacy International in getting in persuading Parliament to change legislation, it has been in the Lords, not the Commons. In the EU, it's a stage removed yet again. Rufus can also talk about this in FFII's work on software patents, but FIPA is part of a cross-Europe group called European Digital Rights. The website's edu.org, if you want to have a look what they do. That edu is made up of 17 different NGOs from across Europe who work on digital rights. We work there on talking to MEPs in Brussels, that's quite a difficult thing to do because there are, I think, 700 of them speaking 20 languages, not perhaps interested, you know, say, the MEPs from Eastern Europe aren't really that interested in what someone from Britain, you know, quite understandably, has to say on an issue. So you need, that's part of the reason we set up EDRI to be a cross-European structure, so you can have British people lobby British MEPs, Hungarian people lobby Hungarian MEPs. Even when you're successful with MEPs, which we were to some extent with the Enforcement of Intellectual Property Rights Directive, which FFII has been very successful with on the Software Patents Directive, you also have to then fight against the Council of Ministers, which is the government, the intergovernmental part of the European Union, who it's very difficult to persuade. They are very secretive in how they make their decisions. That's slightly improving, but it's hard even to see often what they're going to be considering in meetings, certainly to get minutes after meetings. And they're unlikely that the diplomatic staff, in effect, or the civil servants working the Council of Ministers, aren't going to be persuaded by your arguments. You have to persuade the national governments to change their position within the Council of Ministers. So it takes a lot of... It's very wearing. I certainly was absolutely exhausted after being involved in lobbying some of these issues, because it's wearing. You have to persuade people of quite difficult arguments. You don't have many computer scientists in the European or the UK Parliament, unfortunately, or you don't need to be a computer scientist, but anyone who, you know, people who have much of a clue about these issues at all, certainly not, I think, in the way that you have in the US legislatures.
This is a
shame. Yeah. I think I'll wrap up by saying perhaps the way forward is actually for us to infiltrate the existing political parties and to work there rather than to set up yet another digital organization.
I guess I want to speak about two things. One is the potential approaches and how they work. One is, I think, that we're quite lucky in this area, but the real motivation we must remember is that we actually care about something, in my case, open knowledge or open source or whatever. And that's what often motivates people. I mean, as a membership organization, abstract issues are sometimes more difficult. And we have here a whole bunch of concrete things through which you can involve people. So my view is, if you wanted to go for a more grassroots approach, would be to pitch the actual things. Let me give you a concrete. Something which actually makes that concrete. I worked at FFI very extensively, and I went there and lobbied in Brussels for the vote and before that. And I would say it was interesting, even though I would say the whole spectrum of software makers are affected by software patents, especially small and medium-sized enterprises, it is those working on open source who were most motivated. They always were the most motivated section. And that was because concretely, they did something in their work that made them engage with these legal issues and see very directly how they would be affected. More directly than people who, in fact, in monetary times, might lose out more. I mean, you know, the actual other proprietary companies could be sued and all kinds of stuff, and if they were bigger, they would actually be more vulnerable. And so I think it is, like, if people actually, when they could join in with an organization which actually does, I mean, be it, as I said, like Creative Commons, is a way in for them to be, if you want them to get engaged in these issues at a policy level, that's perhaps an optimal way in. And if you're not going to do that, and I say that's the kind of people approach, there's the money approach. Because if you actually look at many membership organisations, they often start out by getting core funding from somewhere, from often rich individuals, which bootstraps them to the point where they're doing enough work and getting enough recognition that they can get membership. And even then, often membership is not financially self-sustaining. And again, like you said, many of the organisations that I've seen, in FFI is particularly true, just a small number of core people who were paid, and where money did come from to pay them, made a huge difference to coordinating all of the kind of cloud of volunteers around them. And it's going to be very difficult to run a policy organisation simply on volunteers. You can run an activist, you can run a kind of doing things, which gets people engaged with the issues organisation, but it's going to be very difficult to run a kind of policy that's talking regularly to government, to the press, without money. So, I mean, I guess this leads me to something about the Open Knowledge Foundation Network, which I couldn't say whether it worked yet or not. And the approach to that was to say, forget, we don't have money, but But we can provide a space for which, in a way that open source projects can come along, open knowledge projects, open content projects, can come along and be supported to some extent, and take part of a loose community that may build up into something. But for the time being, it has seemed very difficult, I think other people say this, to find money in the UK. And that's an idea. In the US, there is a much bigger money-giving culture for these kinds of things. Perhaps because the state does it less well. The state is not doing these things as much. In Europe, you tend to find those kind of bureaucrats who are doing it, and who are supposed to be considering the issues more. And you're not expected to have quite so much outside kind of interest group lobbying. So I know, I mean, I would say the successes have been when you've seen some groups with a small core amount of money that funds a lot of activists very effectively, and which is a motivating issue, which is software patents. And in other areas, I think you've seen quite a lot of, you know, the open source movement here or other things have been actually very successful. Whether it's been at a policy level, I'm not yet certain. But I think, you know, they do make a difference. So
it's funny you should say that, because EFF doesn't take government money. And when I got to England, a lot of people came over and told me, you know, if you want to be an activist in England, the best thing to do is to ask for government money, because there's tons of it for activist groups in the UK. So, and these were kind of think tanky people, and I think that they were confusing the ability for think tanks to get a lot of money out of government with the ability of activist groups to get a lot of money out of government. The things that have really worked well for EFF has been to build coalitions with lots of other activist groups from all across the spectrum. And we've worked with just about everyone you can imagine. We did a campaign that was an effort to restrict the way that people could communicate with government using a system that would try to automatically detect and discard anything that looked like a duplicate comment to in any kind of open proceeding. And we thought that this was ripe for abuse. And we got people who were like pro-space exploration and pro-abortion and anti-abortion and pro-gun and anti-gun, and everyone who ever fires bazooka loads of letters and emails at Congress to join with us on this campaign to keep this from happening. So coalitions work really well. Appeals to constitutionality work eerily well. And now that there is a constitution, I know that it's laborious to bring it to the highest levels of the European courts, but the most telling, I think, of these is the fight over crypto, where the National Security Agency called anyone who exported strong cryptography an arms dealer and put them in jail. And we made all kinds of arguments about why that was bad. And we brought in people who said, well, look, American banks won't be able to flourish if they can't securely encrypt their communications between branches. And that will cause the American economy to fail. And they said, well, you know, you're probably right, but who cares? And then we said, and they said, well, we got this great cipher. It's strong. It's, you know, we'll let the banks use it. It's strong enough. It's good enough. And John Gilmore is one of our founders. He designed a chip that broke this cipher called DES-40 in 2 hours. He wrote a book about it. You can still get it called Cracking DES, right? And up until then, you know, the National Security Agency's position had been, well, like, we've been recruiting like 60% of the PhD mathematician graduating cohort for like 30 years, and we've got a hollow mountain full of them. And they say DES-40 is strong enough, and, you know, your hippie computer scientist says that they're not. Why should we believe you? So John brought a computer into the courtroom and broke DES in 2 hours. And they said, well, that's nice. Go away. And then we turned up and we said, well, but we've got a mathematician who's written code that is part of his research that expresses stronger cryptographic algorithms than the government allows the production, publication, and export of. And we believe that he has a free speech right to publish this in the way that everyone involved in every discipline of the sciences did. And the people who had made the economic and technical arguments thought that we were nuts to be pursuing what they saw as a legal technicality. But when it came down to it, the kinds of judges who review it, specifically this kind of legal technicality, human rights technicalities, tend to be willing to delve into the more material questions, not the questions about whether this is strong enough, not the questions about whether child pornographers might make use of codes or what have you, but the human rights issues that underpin all civil liberties issues. And we won. And we won a judgment that stood in the United States ever since. We had some minor setbacks in the 2600 case, but the principle stands that crypto is legal, and it's now legal everywhere in the world, because once it was being exported from the US, there was no way you're going to keep it from being imported anywhere else. So that kind of appeal to constitutionality is incredibly strong and powerful, and this moment that we're in here in England where there is a constitution finally that can be appealed to, even if the process is laborious, even if it requires...
There isn't a
no. No. No, there is. There's a European constitution. But isn't there a higher court that has a human rights directive that reviews it? I beg your pardon. I'm sorry, I'm misstating the nature of the institution. But thank you. There's an institution that will review whether or not something is coherent with a higher policy document that overrides local law. I think that's the element that has been missing, I think, from impact litigation. And we're in an important moment now, and I think there's room to begin an organization that does that. One of the nice things about that kind of litigation is it's the kind of thing that hungry, ambitious, talented lawyers do for free to make a name for themselves. As we did, our legal director took our Bernstein case for us. Letter-writing campaigns, even with substantively duplicated letters, work in the United States. And I know that there's a lot of opposition in the UK and in Europe to sending duplicative letters in, and there are a lot of people who feel that this is a form of spam or it wastes MPs' time or what have you. The thing is that letter-writing campaign where you're sending in duplicative comments, I believe, don't displace substantive comments. People who have the energy and wherewithal to write a substantive comment do. People who don't send and outsource their substantive comments to people who have the energy to write the substantive comments. And it works. Even where you have bodies that reject the comments, like the FCC rejected a million letters opposing media consolidation, the striking down media consolidation, the Senate took notice of it because that many letters. And the other thing about duplicative letters is that they form a gateway drug to more serious letter writing. Right? If you have to start by being enough of a wonk to write a good letter, there are a lot of people, I think, who never cross the threshold. Yeah. Now, what hasn't worked for us, and to my undying chagrin, is asking tech companies to turn up in places where their interests are being undermined and argue that their interests shouldn't be undermined. So you say, you know, you're an $800 billion tech industry, there's an $80 billion entertainment industry that's telling you how to design your computers and your equipment. We think that you should turn up and say, I'm sorry, this isn't in the cards. We, you know, we're not taking orders from you anymore. They never do it. And I don't know why, and I wish they would.
So I thought I'm going to add something, because I realize that I'm stuck doing activism for a while as well. The big thing that I always thought was missing was money.
Yeah.
We've always kind of historically, every few years, every year or so, the idea of starting a big organization that would represent people has cropped up, and various people have had a bash at it. I had a bash at it at the first version of these things, where I stood up and announced that I was going to spend a year trying to do this, and I had a great first week, which is actually true, because the statutory instrument came through for our IP. And simply by going, okay, I guess it's my job now to be an activist, and writing this up and sending it out to people, we got a huge reaction, and we actually managed to get the government to admit a U-turn. And that was just like, that was simply by having someone employed for a day. Well, you know, then I had to go and work. So I'm gonna open this up to questions now, because I think that's a really interesting thing. And I'm going to start with
Steph,
all right.
Stan and back to me, and they were for you. And I think Danny's, actually, I'll be honest, this is more likely to be a point than a question. But,
you can add, what do you think of that to the end of it?
We've definitely proved in a way that to the best of our ability that we can do these things, or we can do as much as we can without money. We built Stan and Factor MP for £500, and we run their work for you for exactly a year for £2,000 and a load of coffee and a load of people. And the thing, we always look at the EFF and go, wow, look at all the stuff they get to do and the way they do it. And you know, the thing that differentiates the EFF from us is that they've got a load of money and they have these sugar daddies. Now, I've gone round, you know, dot-com billionaires in this country, those that I've met, and I've gone and asked them for money, and I've never seen people disappear so fast from the room
he's very ambient.
I think having sort of given up on the US, on the UK guys, if you look at a lot, if you look at Wozniak and you look at the poor, actually these guys made their money from a global global industry. You know, 75% of the revenues come from countries outside the US. And given, you know, I'm just desperate that having failed to get anyone here to fund it, but we haven't made the kinds of money that those guys have made.
Yeah.
Isn't it time, or is one approach for us to ask them to stop being so fucking parochial and funding a global project? Let's go.
All right. And also, you know, there's more than just .com billionaires in this area as well. There are, I mean, there are definitely organisations and foundations that go into this. And you know, there's a fine institution of doing this kind of thing, which unfortunately none of us, because we're always used to doing stuff on a shoelace and you know, a copy of Linux, we have no access to those people. And it would be great to have some kind of crossover with them, I think.
Can I get some feedback?
Yeah.
Yes.
Having been, I was in the House of Commons until May this year, and I stopped so I could spend my Saturdays in places like this rather than opening garden parties in Sheffield. And the third thing to say is, on the letter writing, it really does work.
Yeah.
The hunting ban, which seems so illogical in terms of taking up a huge amount of time, happened because every single MP in this country received thousands of letters. You talk about making energy concrete. If you make it furry, it's even better in the United Kingdom. So letter writing does work. And if MPs, any MP who got 100 letters on software patents would do something about software patents.
Yeah.
And you can see that in the MPs who did take up the issue. So the first thing to say is it doesn't matter whether they're standardised or not, but get letters in on an issue. In terms of the sort of broader context, the thing about making concrete is important. Just picking up Bruce's point about silent spring. At the moment, the level of debate is still about, well, there's this molecule called DDT, and this is its chemical composition, and this is what it does in a laboratory. It's very technical. It isn't what actually happened with silent spring, which is you stick this in the water, the bugs get ill, the fish eat the bugs, we eat the fish, your babies are deformed. I mean, it became very concrete, and that was the concrete story. That got environmentalism going. It wasn't this sort of abstract, technical thing. And so, as a former legislator, thinking about legislators now, if there's anything we can do, is to make stuff concrete for them. And if any organisation could do that and go and say, this is what will actually happen to your constituents. You know, when they buy a TV, they won't be able to get the TV choices they want. Everything's going to cost them more. They're going to be limited. They're going to be prosecuted for doing normal things at home. If you can get that across and make it concrete, that would be really, really useful. Money, I think, is very important and has been sadly lacking. The other very important point is a bit about liberty. We have got established organisations in the UK, but I think in some way they cloud this area, because what happens is people say, oh, while we're locking up people without trial, we've got these really serious civil liberties issues. Why are you messing around with these trivial second order ones? And so I think that's the other challenge that needs to be overcome somehow. So feedback.
I certainly can second that seeing some of the MEPs' faces in Brussels as they showed me the mounds of printed emails they had received, it truly did make an incredible difference. In fact, they were sick of it. So sick they were going to vote with us.
I think that the appropriate response to a lawmaker who says, I've received too much communication from my constituents, so I'm going to discard it or disregard it, should be, you are a failure as a representative in a democracy, and we're going to take you to task for it, and we're going to make that an issue in the next election, and so on. It shouldn't be to say, well, then let's find a way to reduce the amount of mail you get from your constituents.
Most won't, for that reason.
Okay.
Gentlemen
over there.
Yeah, I wanted to add on since opponents are more... the MPAA and so forth, they're also American organizations, and they're operating in Europe, and they're lobbying Europe, like the Copyright Extension Act was basically passed in Europe first, and then it was blamed on Europe, well, Europe increased. So since the fight is global, shouldn't the American billionaires also fund global?
I think so. I mean, they are to a certain extent, right? I mean, I'm here on a grant from the MacArthur Foundation, which is an American foundation that grants people who work on American issues to work on what is an American issue, which is the global issue of what's happening with digital television regulation and how it impacts PCs. So I think that there is a burgeoning recognition that that's going on, and certainly a lot of funders are funding work at the United Nations now on global copyright treaties and so on. So I agree. about, to give you an idea of our scale, 35% of our funding comes in grants, 65% comes from donations. Most of our donors give $100 a year or less, but a few very high net worth individuals make very large donations. Last year I raised about $150,000, $125,000 that came to donations. So that's kind of the scale of our donations that we get. Convert that into from American pesos into pounds and
I wanted to add to that, just as an irony, but the cost of attending, it's ironic that the person attending DVD forums is from a US organization. I mean, we actually found anyone from Europe, $10,000 or whatever.
€10,000.
€10,000, and then they're in Rio most of the time for the meetings.
Or all over Europe. Yeah.
One of the problems here is a bootstrapping one, in that it's all very well saying, well, we should get some Americans to pay for this, but no one's around to ask. This is definitely one of the problems, because you, in order to effectively ask,
I
you
rooted it.
That's why you're saying San Francisco.
I did suggest this kind of idea, I have to say, in March to other people, but I mean, they are giving a lot of money there already, some of these people. There's a kind of reluctance.
So the patent fight win, though, is the perfect jumping off point. Turn up and say, we just won the patent fight, we're going to do the next one next, and we're blooded and we need some money to do it.
One of the problems, though, in the UK is a lack of a cohesive community of activists. We've got a lot of kind of small groups that are doing bits and pieces, but there's no kind of feeling that we're all sort of on the same page, that we're all sort of pulling together. It's a lot of disconnections between different groups. I don't think a UK version of the EFF could help kind of bring everyone together.
Yes. I mean, I think also you have to live, I mean, I said diversity. The fact of the matter is, sadly, you see it, not everyone wants to go under the same banner. And for example, one of the differences, let's say with FFI, several people actually come to me and said, why doesn't FFI come and do stuff on geodata or on these other things? But unfortunately, one of their strengths and most of their funding comes from organizations who don't give a fig about geodata. They just don't care, and they will be unhappy in some way for their funding to go for that. So I agree with you, but it's also the case that specific projects are often able, I think the coalition's example before. Coalitions, on a specific issue, you can get a lot of sign on, and it's difficult to bring everyone under the same roof.
Well, I'm not saying we should necessarily make everybody work under the same name or same banner, but to have some kind of community where there can be more sort of discussion and sharing of information.
So you're
not necessarily saying, you must use our new banner to do this.
I mean, there's even a common calendar where you can find out what kind of events are happening.
There's a copy night now.
Is there a copy night?
Yeah.
In the UK?
You can use it for anywhere.
I just wanted to take a quick poll, or a bunch of polls. So, who here sees themselves as somebody who's been active, has done some active stuff in this? And who here would do so in the future if they had any idea of what to do? So, keep your hands up. Okay, so there's room for growth here. Who here subscribes to OTK? This isn't like one kid. All right, so that will be a good place to announce this kind of thing.
Yeah.
To be absolutely honest, one of the reasons I wanted to have this discussion is to see what the shape of something that would be a clear account of this stuff. Not a British EFF, but just a way of continuing this kind of conversation. And what we'll do is we'll carry on having this discussion, and then announce something and work out some sort of central clearinghouse, possibly around your new organisation, because it's about time one of us started a new organisation.
On October 1st and 2nd, and around that whole week, when the DTI is running a creative economy conference, to which no one basically can attend except writers so far as I'm understanding. So the 1st and 2nd, there's going to be a World Summit on Free Information Infrastructures in London. Which is organised by a whole bunch of people, Tate London, Node London, Aegis of Node London, Cyber Salon, the Open Knowledge Foundation Network, a whole bunch, and that might be another opportunity for a lot of these groups to come together. We actually have three cultures going to have its first inaugural actual meeting, which anyone can come up and join and be a part, take part in a decision forum that we'll run, for example. So that's one suggestion in 2 months' time for an actual
physical meeting.
What's it called? The World Summit on Free Information Infrastructures. There's going to be another one in Mumbai next year, which is funded by the OSI, actually, if you are, which is quite a whole sequence.
We're kind of running out of time, so I just want to get one more question in.
Why don't you take three more questions and no answer?
How's that? Brilliant. Okay, yes. So let's start with the gentleman who's
doing
it.
Me?
Thank you. I have some great points. Rufus brought up diversity in environmental groups. I'd say that's good, but most environmental groups don't do anything. I think it's a bit scale-free. You get these couple of people actually doing stuff, but the second one on membership, I think Ian brought up Phil, I think that's a bad implementation of sensitivity. Sending someone a check and so on isn't the best way to get members, especially if it's online. Three, Corey brought up people saying things in the EFF's name. I think the EFF already gave EFF Finland the right to do some of this stuff.
No, that's a design. Totally separate organization.
But the name is not the problem, right?
Oh,
okay, my fourth point is, if it's going to be anyone, it's going to be one of you three guys. So if you haven't done it yet, is it ever going to happen? Is it just you don't want to do it?
Why can't it be you?
Because I think, as you said, as Ian said, the membership organization is always falling over. And unless you have a load of money or you have a personality, like someone has 100 million hits a day or Womo or whatever, to do this.
Well, I'd certainly be happy to blog anything you say. I've got a pretty full-time job.
I would also say that I think it's
also impressive. Sorry, if you're not. I just got one more point. And I was just going to ask the audience, you asked them, would they be willing to give their time, but I think it's important to ask them, would they be willing to give 5 minutes or something. So I think I'd put that as a poll to the audience.
Okay, audience, you have any question. Who would pay 5 or 9? Alrighty.
It's a lot more than the average EFF supporter gives.
Yeah. We should do a Patreon thing for this. We should do a... I'll announce an
interview.
Okay, two more questions.
Two questions.
Yeah.
A lot of organizations, I think it's interesting. I'm a little bewildered by the fact that there is actually an end. My name is Gavin Hill. I work for Rufus on the Software Grants Campaign, which is quite an amazing introduction to European and national politics. What organizations outside of digital rights do you see as being models for campaigning? Because the fact of the matter is, there is the EFF and there is the FFI in Europe, and they have sort of very different structures and approaches. And I don't think it's possible for them both to take the same agendas and the same policies, and I think they will focus on what they've succeeded at. But my real point is, what other organizations do you see that you can borrow ideas from? I think there's two, People and Planet and the National and NUS, because I've experienced in both of them, and I've seen what they actually do, despite people may think of them. But what organizations, what things do you think can be borrowed from other organizations to improve the environment?
Yeah, okay. Who else wanted to ask a question? One more
week?
He's like secretly in trouble. Where's James? Are you?
I'm ready.
Okay, so we'll take one more question.
10 minutes.
I'm kind of sorry to be last at this point, but first of all, the upshot, I just have to congratulate everyone involved in the Software Grants Division for that.
Woo! Woo!
Are the British different from the Americans in what way? We don't really have a rules or a constitution. Our whole politics is made up of a gentleman's agreement. So impact litigation, I mean, until the European Human Rights Act came through, I mean, it's just symptomatic of the kind of different ways we work politically in this country. And I'm upset we haven't got to talk about that more today. And all people in this room excluded. We're just not that technically literate compared to the Americans. We haven't had the internet for that long. I mean, well, I didn't care. And all that kind of stuff. I just wonder if now's the beginning, that's great, but I don't think we need to be too down on ourselves. And I haven't got there yet. So that is positive.
Hey, just very quickly,
the big difference is actually a growing generation of lawyers and people like that in the US who are getting experience in this, and I think really that's happening here now. It's just they don't have the opportunities. And as far as technical measure, it's bridging more technically than really
general. I once went to a meeting where an American studio executive who's an engineer spent an hour arguing with the cryptographers about why he couldn't encrypt a single bit. because you can guess it in two tries, it's not the time you can guess it in one. He was like, I don't care, I'll pad it with 1,023 bits of noise, then it'll be long enough. Anyway.
I think the sort of half flippant but half serious response to what lessons can be learned from NUS is, once we have a digital rights organisation, there is a clear path up to the cabinet, being president of the NUS, and you look at them all now, Jack Straw and friends are all in the cabinet, then you'll get the kind of politically motivated people involved that perhaps that's one of our failures. We're interested in the issues more than the growing politics.
Well, I don't know. The growing politics is actually quite fine for us at 7 points on the ceiling or floor. I want to say one thing is actually, I think, in response to your comment, I think we are going places. I mean, we're actually winning formal fights. I mean, basically, like, I want to say, I always think one day you may look back at the high point of right extremism was tripped. You know, that was the beginning. 1995, once people started saying, WIPO. I don't know how many people in the room actually know what WIPO stands for. Put up your hand if you know.
Well,
oh my God, it's amazing. This is mixed, okay. But generally, I mean, this march, there were like 17 civil society NGOs in WIPO. I mean, that was like, an order of magnitude more than like ever had been there 2 years ago. And so I think there is really serious progress. I mean, we've actually won some fights rather than just losing the well. And I think we only need to go on from that point to better strength. And IP fights have been lost for 250 years, really. And it's only at this point that we're starting to win them. So I think we can take a lot of heart from where things have gone in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I agree. EFF spent a lot of time soul-seeking for a decade. It went through all kinds of weird phases. It went to D.C. and tried to be policy lobbyists and failed completely and had a huge fission, and half the group left, and the board of directors resigned, and it was just, a complete debacle and had to recover from that. For a while, it was running an organization called Trusty that gave you a little badge to put on your website for running your privacy policies, but you can keep the badge up forever, but you'd only have, but we'd only re-examine your privacy policies if you paid us, so you could pay us on. It went through all kinds of ups and downs between being founded and getting to where it is today. As Rufus says, what's going on in WIPO gives me more heart than ever. I think there's a real worldwide climate of awareness and activist response to increased encroachments on personal liberty, particularly through copyright instruments, but also elsewhere. WIPO, 2 years ago when I went to my first WIPO meeting, 2.5 years ago, I was one of three civil society NGOs. The meeting before that, there had been the one. That was the first one to ever turn up at one of these things, and now there's 20. And you hear us just go one after the other after the other. We've got better technology than they do. We can write down everything they say using ad hoc wireless networks and submit that into the room, and then we publish it at lunch, and the national delegations get calls from their capitals, after we publish what we publish, because they start getting calls from journalists in countries around the world, and they change their positions after lunch. I mean, it's amazing, right? And they're so freaked out that, we turn up at WIPO and our papers go missing. We find them in the rubbish bins and the toilets. The last time around yesterday, I heard a representative from the Pharmaceutical Industry Association's umbrella organization identify his organization as a nonprofit public interest group. this is how incredibly desperate they've become. I think we're starting to win.